Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. On behalf of our co-sponsors, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, NCSIS, I'd like to welcome you this afternoon to our discussion on religious freedom and state policy in Central Asia. We have three distinguished speakers joining us today on the panel: Igor Rotar, Eric McGlinchey, and Catherine Cosman. Igor Rotar comes to us from, I believe, Bishkek, is that right? Igor is based in Bishkek, where he is currently the Central Asia correspondent for the Norway-based Forum 18 News Service, an organization that promotes religious freedom on the basis of Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Igor is, for those of you who have been following Central Asia for some years, is a longtime well-respected analyst, researcher, and journalist. He has written a number of articles in his career for the Jamestown Foundation and its various publications. He was also a reporter for the UK-based Keston Institute, and in the 90s for Nezavisimaya Gazeta and Izvestia in Russia. And Igor was educated at the Department of Geography of Moscow State University, where he launched his quite diverse and lengthy career. Our second speaker is Eric McGlinchey, who is currently an assistant professor of politics and government at George Mason University. He has also served. He has also taught at Iowa State University and been a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford. Received his PhD from Princeton University. And Dr. McGlinchey is a well-known expert of Central Asia, with a focus on comparative politics, regime change in Central Asia and elsewhere. Perhaps sounds more ominous than it should be. Political Islam and the effects of information communication technology on state and society. Dr. McGlinchey has written articles on regime change and political Islam for a number of publications, and he's also currently finishing up a manuscript on the region. And finally, we have Catherine Cosman, who joins us from our co-sponsors. She joined the staff of the Commission as senior policy analyst for the OSCE region in 2003. She has also had a long and esteemed career at the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, then Human Rights Watch, and since then the Free Trade Union Institute, the OSCE, the National Endowment for Democracy, and RFERL. Now, our topic today is on state and religion in Central Asia, and when the discussion turns to the interaction of the state and religious organizations in the region, we often discuss radical organizations, most notably the IMU, Hizbut Tahrir, and others like that. We decided this afternoon what we would like to do is focus on in particular, two topics related to the interaction of the state and religious organizations that do not focus on radicalism per se. One topic regards the state policy and social attitudes towards religious minorities in the region, and in particular converts from Islam, the dominant religion. And the second topic that we would like to spend some time discussing today concerns something that is often neglected here in Washington, namely the relationship between the governments of the region and the mainstream Muslim communities, the extent to which the state oversees, monitors, controls, even places of worship, religious literature, religious practice, and the implications of that kind of oversight and control on religious freedom, and also the obverse, the extent to which mainstream Muslim communities either resist or accommodate state control over religion, and more generally, the authoritarian nature of local regimes, or the shifting political nature of the regimes, as we have seen in different countries. So without further ado, I would like to turn the panel over to our presenters. Igor will be focusing primarily on Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and perhaps Tajikistan as well. Eric will focus his comments on Kyrgyzstan, and Catherine Cosman will focus on Turkmenistan, and then we'll be able to open up for discussion afterwards. Igor, thank you.
You want to speak about Islamic radical afternoon today or not?
Not particularly. Maybe in discussion it will come up.
Because I can say it.
Hello, my name is Igor Rotar. I'm Central Asia correspondent of Forum 18. At first, I want to excuse me for my bad English, but I hope that you will understand me. And this is a summary of my talk, so it maybe help you. My talk is Central Asia, religious freedom in Central Asia. This issue needs to be considered in two levels. First level, state policy restricted for religious freedom. Second level, intolerance in everyday life. We will consider each of these aspects in details. First, about state policy. Here again, the issue need to be considered in two plans. First, legal acts that limits believers' rights, and state repression, the repression of believers without support of legislation. About state policy. The most repressive base has been established in Uzbekistan. The Uzbek religious law bans the activity of any religious organization without registration. Religious activity without registration is punished by article of administrative and criminal court. The main sentence for religious activity without registration is 3 years in prison. But, however, in practice, minorities, not Muslim believers, are usually given fines or go for a few days in prison, not for a long time. But the Uzbek authorities frequently use very harsh measures to members of unregistered Muslim communities. But authorities usually accuse Muslim believers not for illegal religious activity, but for participating in religious extremist, separatist, fundamentalist, or other banned organization, and also undermining of constitutional basis. It is interesting that in practice, it's really not possible to resist a religious community in Uzbekistan. For example, Jehovah's Witness were refused in registration 8 times. The Uzbek religious law also banned proselytes and missionary activity. Jehovah's Witness are most frequent victim of this ban. It can explain that basic aspect of Jehovah's Witness religion is missionary activity. As a rule, missionaries are fined, but sometimes they go to the prison, but for a few days, not for many years. around a year ago, President of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, introduced amendments to religious law. Now, religious activity without registration is prohibited in Kazakhstan too. The punishment is fine. But usually, most believers who I spoke say that the authorities not often find it unregistered community in Kazakhstan. And now this amendment don't work very good. On the whole, the framework of the other Central Asia states does not contain legislation that restricts believers' rights. On the whole, the framework of the other Central Asia states does not contain legislation that restricts believers' rights. The only such law is an article in Turkmenistan Administrative Court, which prohibited religious activity without registration. The punishment is the same fine. In January last year, the Religious Committee of religious committee of Tajikistan drafted new religious law which restricted believers' rights in harsher than Uzbek law. Under the new draft law, unregistered religious community would be banned, as well as missionary activity and proselytism. The law also introduced a quota for religious establishment permitted in populated area. But under international pressure, the government delayed consideration of new law. But in my opinion, a major problem is that government often press the believers without some legislation. So if we only see legislation, the law about religious, we can look a real picture in Central Asia. The most often the repression without some legislation are occur in Turkmenistan. You can look also the monument, Niyazov monument in Turkmenistan. But maybe now the situation is not clear because after death of Niyazov, maybe situation is changing. But now we don't know real situation. But also other centralized republic also often press believers without registration. For example, sometimes women in hijab, you can look women in hijab in Dushanbe, are pressed by government in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Usually press not old women, but school girls. In some school it is prohibited go in school in hijab. There are also not official quota number of mosques in populated area, both in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Also, despite of the Tajik religious law, allow religious activity without registration, authorities often press unregistered community. Now I want to speak about other aspects of religious freedom, religious intolerance in everyday life. The main problem of intolerance in everyday life is intolerance by Muslim toward former Muslim who have converted to Christianity. We can explain it. Two factors can explain this problem. First, under Sharia law, the Muslim who have converted to Christianity or other faith have to be killed. Uzbek and Tajik are usually hard believers, and people of these nationalities consider former Muslim as apostates. Really, however, Kyrgyz and Kazakh used to be nomad not so long ago. And Islam is practiced only on everyday superficial level, and is closely linked with pagan beliefs. But the problem is that Kazakh and Kyrgyz look people who have converted to Christianity as trait of national identity. For example, many Kazakh and Kyrgyz said me that if Kazakh converted to Christianity, he is not now real Kazakh. He is because it is a part of national identity. We can see many harassment against Central Asia former Muslim who have converted to Christianity or other faiths in all Central Asia Republic. For example, this summer, the crowd of Muslim people invaded Christian church in the southern Kyrgyzstan. They have beaten the pastor, the priest of this church. Then they throw him in the street and in the garden, and they did fire in the garden of church and burned many hundreds copies of Bible and other Christian literature. Then they wrote in the gate of church, the house is sold. At the end of December 2005, a Protestant believer from Kyrgyzstan too, Usmanov, was murdered. All local people are sure that Usmanov was killed as a traitor of Islam. It is interesting that his murders have never been found. In 2004, Protestant pastor Sergei Besarab from northern Tajikistan was murdered in the town of Asfara. The authorities said that it was work of an Islamic radical organization, Bayat. Bayat members were very unhappy that Besarab preached among Tajiks. There are also some case of kangaroo court both in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. When I spoke with the chief of government religious committee of Uzbekistan, he said to me that when we adopted law banning missionary activity, Western countries accused us that we violate religious freedom. But the problem is that in our condition, Christianity propaganda can provoke bloody conflicts. In some reason, this position have some reason. I don't agree with this, but I can agree that this position have some reason. Because Protestants are very active in Central Asia Republic. For example, you can look Protestant poster in the city of Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. It is interesting that population of Protestant in Bishkek may be less than 5%, but you can find more Protestant poster than Orthodox or Muslim poster. And of course, this fact, local Muslim are very unhappy about this activity. There are also other problems that in private conversation with me, Uzbek officials said that they have to press independent Muslim because they afraid Islamic fundamentalism. And in this situation, if they press only Muslim, but don't press religious minorities. Muslims think that the state follow openly anti-Islamic policy. They said that we don't care really about Protestant, but we can't only press Muslim, and we can follow one law for all people. So it is a very serious problem, in my opinion, for Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. In conclusion, I can say that states in Central Asia are not working to create the condition for religious tolerance. However, the government of these countries signed up international agreement that commits them to religious freedom. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. McGlinchey, please.
Thanks, Corey, for the invitation to talk. Let me just begin by saying that, at least in my mind, 2006 has been probably the worst year in Kyrgyzstan as far as state-Islam relations. I've been working on Kyrgyzstan for probably a good decade or so, and this is by far the worst year I've seen as far as tension between both sides of the state and Islam writ large. I mean, both Islam in the full spectrum here. What I'd like to do in this presentation are two things. First, I'd like to provide examples of what I mean by this being the worst year of relations between state and society, Islam. And I'll do two things here. First, I'll provide examples of increasing social mobilization of a wide range of Islam-centered mobilization groups. And I have to say from the get-go, I know this is a very unwieldy term, Islam-centered mobilization groups. These are really politically charged terms. If one says Islamist, of course, that means radical. If one says Islamic, that's the distinction. I'm talking about both. So when I say Islam-centered, I mean this covers the full spectrum of both Islamist and Islamic. That's why I use the somewhat unwieldy phrase. So that's the first thing I want to look at, is the mobilization of Islam-centered, the increase in mobilization of Islam-centered groups. And the second thing I want to look at is a parallel increase, maybe not even parallel, but perhaps even a disproportionate increase in state monitoring of these groups. And again, of all kinds of Islam-centered mobilization groups. And what I'd like to do is provide some kind of explanation for why we're seeing these two mechanisms or these two things move in tandem. And the first thing I'd like to say, and this is an argument I've made in the Uzbek case, is that these two dynamics are mutually reinforcing. State repression of Islam increases mobilization of Islam. The growth in one encourages the growth of the other. There's an iterative effect, an interaction effect, if you will, between the two. But whereas in Uzbekistan, I'd be comfortable in arguing that that's probably the primary dynamic of what's going on. I think there's more going on in Kyrgyzstan than simply mobilization encouraging state response and state response encouraging mobilization in turn. I actually think in Kyrgyzstan, there's a really strong grassroots interest that is also driving the renaissance of Islam that perhaps isn't so much driving the renaissance that we've been seeing in Uzbekistan. Kyrgyzstan saw a greater degree of Sovietization, saw a greater degree of Russification than Uzbekistan did, in multiple ways. But the biggest thing here is the Islamic identity in Uzbekistan, I would argue, was considerably more secure throughout the Soviet period than the Islamic identity in Kyrgyzstan. And there's a lot of reasons for this, and we can get into them, but perhaps not so important for this presentation. What's happening in Kyrgyzstan is there's a desire now that I don't think we necessarily see in Uzbekistan to finally, at long last, define who they are as Muslims. So there's a desire to reach out to all kinds of different actors to help define who they are, Kyrgyz, as Muslims, where in Uzbekistan we don't see this similar kind of dynamic. Uzbek Muslims are fairly secure in their identities. And again, I'm speaking in broad brush strokes, and I realize that. But I think there's a greater curiosity in defining the identity of Islam in Kyrgyzstan, what they're going to be, and there's a greater certainty in Uzbekistan of what that Muslim identity is. It's a little abstract. Let me give you a concrete example, and maybe some of you saw this in the press, and I think it gets away from the kind of jargon that I've been using and really phrases it in an everyday kind of understandable way. There's a village in Kyrgyzstan called Petrovka. It's in Chuy Oblast, just right outside of Bishkek. Petrovka, very Russian name. Chuy Oblast, very strong Russian-speaking place. And there's a Hohoz, a former Hohoz worker, who owns a number of sheep and had a female sheep, who the ewe just gave birth to a lamb. And he thought really nothing of this new lamb until one day when a young boy studying at a local mosque walked by and looked at the spots on this lamb and said, wow, that the spots formed the word in Arabic script of Allah, of the prophet. And the Holzwerker, the former Soviet Holzwerker who was Russian speaking, didn't understand Arabic, didn't understand the script. But when he saw this, and when the young boy who's been studying at the mosque pointed this out to him, all of a sudden this Holzwerker discovered or wanted to build his identity, wanted to become Muslim. He started reading namaz. He started doing things that one Kyrgyz people think Muslim should do. He was rediscovering, or he was discovering his identity. So you have someone in a very Russified area, in Petrovka, who speaks Russian, who knew nothing about Islam, caught up in this excitement of a lamb that apparently has the word Allah written on, or somehow the spots form Allah on an Arabic script on his, do lamb have sheep, or do they have fur, or I don't know what they have. But anyway, he saw this. So basically, I'm just trying to give you an example of how the Soviet identity is intermixing with this new desire for Islam. And that's what I'm pointing to in the Kyrgyz case, and we don't see this kind of identity, this kind of identity creation dynamic in the Uzbek case. By the way, I haven't seen this lamb on eBay yet. If it comes up right next to the toast with the image of Jesus, we can begin bidding. Apparently, he doesn't want to sell it. Okay, so that's the central idea I want to get across here. Let me begin by talking about increase in social mobilization in Kyrgyzstan since the beginning of 2006. We've seen a new kind of social protest, Islam-centered protest in Kyrgyzstan that we really haven't seen before, certainly didn't see under Akayev. And we're seeing mass protests in Kyrgyzstan which are directly targeting the state and the state control of the muftiyat, the spiritual directorate. It's a very state-centered, anti-state kind of protest. And let me just give you a couple of examples to give you an idea of why I think 2006 is such a sea change kind of year here. In May in Jalalabad, just one example, there was a huge uprising about the wearing of hijab. And typically, hijab hasn't been such of a big deal in Kyrgyzstan. Young girls have been able to wear this in school, but the local state administrator decided that he was going to take this on, and he had enough of the growth of this Islamic identity in Jalalabad. And he went one step further, and this is really where the uproar came. He went on the record and he said, quote, "It's no secret that many of the prostitutes who come down here from the rural areas and border regions often dress in the hijab. What the woman is wearing does not necessarily reflect her morality." So this is a direct attempt by a state official to go after the hijab. We really didn't see much of this under Akayev. Another example, in June, when I was this overlapped with one of my research trips this past June, the Jamaat-i-Musulman, the Society of Muslims, threatened that they were going to protest in Bishkek, and they claimed that they had numbers in the thousands. And they were protesting because the state had refused to allocate them the land that the state had promised for the building of a new mosque and a new cultural center. This Society of Muslims already had the money to build the mosque. They had a $2 million guarantee from Qatar, and they also had $10 million for a cultural center from Saudi Arabia. So they had the money, the state had promised, but they couldn't get the land. And if you go to the central mosque in Bishkek, you'll realize it's a tiny mosque which really can't service the population. There is a need, really, for more space for prayer. And apparently this had been something that had been in the work, and Bakiyev backtracked on this. Ultimately, Bakiyev gave the space for the new mosque, and the protests didn't come off. But other protests have been coming off. You may recall that there was the unfortunate killing of an imam in southern Kyrgyzstan, Kamalov, this summer. And what's interesting about this is one, how the Kyrgyz government's story has changed about how this imam died in response to mass protests. Originally, the Kyrgyz government claimed that Kamalov was a radical and he was shot while he was sitting next to Hizbut Tahrir members. And later the government, after many protests, said that Kamalov was being kidnapped, and unfortunately he was caught in the crossfire as the government was trying to somehow secure his release. This sparked massive protests. In November, almost 2 months ago, 2,000 strong protests, grassroots kind of uprising. The people are trying to get rid of the Mufti. Southern imams in Kyrgyzstan are very upset with the Muftiyat and the northern leadership. So basically, what I'm saying is we're seeing uprising after uprising after uprising, which is something we really haven't seen in Kyrgyzstan before, and it's very much directed at the state. So quite problematic. Again, this is a kind of an identity of Islam which takes the state as an enemy, and by doing so, uses this as a language of resistance. So we're seeing a politicization of Islam, whereas we haven't seen it before. I'm not saying that this is a bad thing, but it potentially could lead towards problems between the state and society, which we've seen in Uzbekistan, and that's something to keep an eye out on. Okay, the flip side, the state attention towards social mobilization. I mean, I've talked about some of these things already, the killing of Imam Kamalov, the tension over the building of the mosque. One thing I'd like to stress, though, and I think this is perhaps the single most distressing thing that's happened in the past year, Kyiv, in contrast to Kyiv, has entered into an agreement with the Uzbeks to coordinate the security services monitoring religious activities, particularly Muslim activities in the southern region. Kyiv said that the reason for doing this is, he said, quote, President Karimov and I decided that our republics had to pool our efforts against international terrorism and extremist religious schools. He made that comment on July 30th. Kamalov, the popular imam in Uzbekistan, in Kyrgyzstan, in Karasu, was killed 1 week later, and also it's thought that he was killed during a joint operation by Kyrgyz and Uzbek security services. We've never seen anything like this in Kyrgyzstan before. This is a complete change from the previous administration. The government claims that it's jailed about 127 extremists over the past year. You can take these numbers for what it's worth. This represents an increase over past years. So, I mean, again, what we're seeing is a ramping up of Kyrgyz government repression, or perhaps there are real causes for this. Maybe there is terrorism. I don't know. But we're seeing a growing tension between these two sides. I think that's something to keep in mind. Let me just briefly turn towards the causal explanation side of this about why it's happening. I said in the introduction that there's probably some kind of interaction between the two. There is something going on like what we see in Uzbekistan. The Uzbek government represses Muslim activists. The activists become more radicalized and more likely to mobilize. There is some of that going on. At the same time, let me return to this idea of this renaissance based on curiosity. This is where I think the future of Kyrgyz Islam really lies. This kind of interaction effect, this is going to be important, but what's even more important is if you look at where Kyrgyz are turning for self-definition. To a certain extent, yes, they are turning towards their traditional clergy, but also they're turning elsewhere. I already mentioned that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are giving money for building the mosque and the cultural center in Bishkek. They're only two actors, and they're not the biggest actors. One group to pay particular attention is the Fethullah Gulen organization from Turkey. This is ostensibly an education-based organization. They're pervasive throughout the Kyrgyz educational system. If you look at Kyrgyz Manas University, this is essentially run by Fethullah Gulen. If you look at the Osh Theological Department in southern Kyrgyzstan, this is very much connected to the same Turkish group. They have a filial in Bishkek, same kind of thing which is going on. A lot of the teachers, although outwardly they don't teach this in their classes, after classes there's this is something that is incorporated within the whole higher education experience. Pakistan is also a player, or at least allegedly a player. The Tabligh movement from Pakistan. Oddly enough, they seem to be most active in Balikchi, just outside of Bishkek, a little bit east of Bishkek. I guess what I'm saying is Kyrgyz are turning elsewhere to define their image of who they are as Muslims, and it's a wide open playing field, and we're not quite sure where they're going to turn in the future, and there are all these different actors, I guess what I'd like to leave you with, if I could, and I know this is dangerous as a social scientist, but I mean, you could essentially imagine a 2x2 grid going on here, where you have this interaction effect between state repression and increasing Islamic mobilization, perhaps radicalism, and then you have on the other side different international forces, some of them moderating, some of them radicalizing. You could imagine a worst case scenario, bottom right corner of this 2x2, we have growing repression on the government side, increasing this desire for mobilization. You could have radicalizing international effects. If you're stuck in this lower right-hand corner, the future for Kyrgyzstan could be quite problematic. I'm not saying that this is where Kyrgyzstan's going, but if these two effects come together, it could be quite bad. And let me just leave you with one quote, which I think points to the potential of this direction. Not that I'm saying it's going to go in this direction. Earlier I talked about Kamalov, Imam Kamalov, the imam from Karasu in southern Kyrgyzstan who died or was killed in a joint Kyrgyz-Uzbek security operation. And this is his mosque has now is being run by his son, Muhammad Rashad. And this is what he said of his father's death. He said in the future of Islam in Kyrgyzstan, he said that, quote, "There are no terrorists with guns in their hands in our Kyrgyzstan. But if there continue to be actions of this kind, such groups will emerge. Wounded hearts will have their vengeance." So it's a word of warning. Kyrgyzstan is becoming, unfortunately, more problematic and I think really deserves our attention. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to invite Catherine Cosman to discuss a country that has attracted considerable interest in recent weeks, Turkmenistan.
Thank you, Corey. The Commission also appreciates that Corey and CSIS agreed to co-sponsor this event. I'd like to focus on several main areas. While some of these issues may be overtaken by recent events, namely the death of Niyazov, nevertheless, I think they determine the current status quo. The first is Turkmenistan's personality cult, or perhaps I should say Niyazov's personality cult. The government policies towards Islam, the country's majority population and religion, and Turkmenistan's law on religion and policy towards religious minorities, and the country's largest religious minority being the Russian Orthodox Church. And finally, a few speculations on the country's future direction, although it's very early to be speculating. I wanted to start with a loyalty oath quote, just to give you a flavor of the religion of the state and the state of religion, if I may. Turkmenistan, you're always with me in my thoughts and in my heart. For the slightest evil against you, let my hand be cut off. For the slightest slander about you, let my tongue be cut off. At the moment of my betrayal of my motherland, of my sacred banner, of her sacred banner, of Sapar Murat Turkmenbashi, the great father of the Turkmen, let my breath stop. This was required on frequent occasions of those who wanted to prove their loyalty to the state, and this, I think, helps one see the flavor of the personality cult, which has already, I think it's fair to say, assumed the dimension of a state-imposed religion, bolstered by the forceful official promotion of Niyazov's two-volume work known as Ruhname, which constitute his spiritual thoughts. In March 2006, in fact, Niyazov announced on Turkmen State TV that those who read the Ruhname three times would, quote, be assured a place in heaven. Students are required to study the Ruhname at all public schools and institutions, and the study of the Ruhname has even replaced some subjects in the school curricula. Niyazov used these teachings in part to supersede other established religious codes as well as historical and cultural texts and thereby influence citizens' religious and cultural behavior. I'm quoting from the State Department at this point. A July 2002 law instructs parents and guardians to, quote, bring children up in the spirit of unshakable spiritual values embodied in the holy Ruhname. In late 2005, after police raided a registered Baptist church in the town of Denau, Ethnic Turkmen congregants were released from detention only after they promised to read the Ruhnameh rather than the New Testament. I'd like now like to focus a bit on Islam as it shows in a wider context the personality cult and what perhaps some reasons why Niyazov did what he did. He interpreted his own view of Islam as part of his way of bolstering, again, his own version of Turkmen identity. Imams were instructed by the government to repeat a loyalty oath after each daily prayer, the loyalty oath I already cited. Apparently, in late 2005, mullahs were ordered to stop reading the Quran in mosques and restrict themselves to the Ruhnameh. The president's books must be displayed in mosques, and there's some dispute whether also in churches, alongside the Quran and the Bible. Ruhnameh quotations have even been carved alongside the Quran on the country's largest mosque in Kipchak, which is Niyazov's hometown where he's now buried. Turkmenistan's former chief mufti, Nasrullah ibn Ibadullah, who opposed this requirement, was sentenced in a closed trial in March 2004 to 22 years in prison, reportedly for treason due to his alleged link to the alleged 2002 assassination attempt against Niyazov, despite rumors that he was released in a recent prisoner amnesty. Reportedly, however, he remains in prison. As far back as 2000, Niyazov reportedly ordered Muslims to renounce the hadiths, sayings attributed to the Prophet Muhammad that did not appear in the Quran. In March 2004, Niyazov proclaimed that no new mosques should be built, and some seven mosques were ordered to be torn down and were in fact destroyed that same year. In July 2005, Niyazov ordered the publication of a list of religious rituals common to all Turkmen, and reportedly secret police attend mosques to identify Muslims who perform religious rites in a way that differs from this officially prescribed so-called Turkmen practice. Since August 2005, according to the exiled Turkmenistan Helsinki Foundation, secret police increased their monitoring of young men who regularly attend mosque in the Ahal region. The secret police ordered imams to hang a list of mosque attendees on their mosques. Only those whose names appear on the lists are allowed to attend mosque services. The Turkmen government limits the numbers of Muslims allowed to perform the Hajj. In 2006, for example, only 188 of the country's official quota of 4,500 were allowed to go to Mecca. Apparently, 188 was the number that could easily fit onto one airplane load. In the past year, the Turkmen State University Theological Faculty was dissolved, leaving only one institution of Islamic education open, with the government controlling the curriculum of that institution. I should also say that Gulen, the Turkish group, whom Eric mentioned, is still allowed to keep its schools open in Turkmenistan, I learned recently in Turkey. Muslims, however, are not allowed to travel abroad for religious education. Now I'd like to turn briefly to the Turkmen law on religion and policies towards members of religious minorities. Since Turkmenistan became independent in 1991, religious groups have been required to register with the government in order to legally engage in religious activities. The 1997 version of this law effectively banned all religious groups except the state-controlled Sunni Muslim Board and the Russian Orthodox Church, although religious instruction was severely limited even for those groups. The Russian Orthodox community has also been affected by the repressive policies of Niyazov, who has banned residents of Turkmenistan from receiving Russian publications by mail. And all Russian Orthodox parishes were re-registered in November 2005, but Turkmen authorities refused to allow the Russian Orthodox community to build a new cathedral in the capital city of Ashgabat, although Niyazov allocated land for that purpose 10 years ago. The Turkmen government continues to attempt to isolate local parishes from the wider Russian Orthodox Church, in part by pressuring the local church to take the Turkmen parishes away from the jurisdiction of the Central Asian Diocese in Uzbekistan and put them directly under the Patriarch of Moscow, who in July 2005, nevertheless, rejected this proposal. Turkmenistan's revised religion law in 2003 further codified the Turkmen government's highly restrictive policies, effectively banning most religious activities. It established criminal penalties for those found guilty of taking part in so-called illegal religious activity, and it requires religious groups to coordinate with the Turkmen government any contact with co-religionists abroad. Religious believers have sometimes been banned from international travel. A Hare Krishna follower, for example, who planned to visit a temple in Russia, was prevented from traveling. She was later imprisoned, and I've just received word from Forum 18 that she was recently released as part of a large prisoner amnesty. In response to international pressure, Niyazov issued a decree in March 2004 stating that religious communities may register and will no longer have to meet the requirement of a minimum of 500 members in order to do so. Nevertheless, the decree only amended numerical requirements for registration and not the penalties for violating it. No religious literature can be printed in Turkmenistan, and the import of religious materials is basically impossible. In May 2004, Niyazov issued several decrees decriminalizing unregistered religious activities and easing other requirements for registration. That eventually resulted in the registration of 9 small religious groups, mostly Protestants, plus Hare Krishna and Baha'i, in addition to the majority Sunni Muslim and Russian Orthodox Church. However, there are several religious groups which either fear to apply to register or have decided not to do so, and thereby run the risk and the reality of heavy fines and the possibility of imprisonment, although now it's under the administrative code rather than the criminal code. Turkmen officials have also noted that the new registration requirements don't mean that religious communities may gather in private homes, or that religious believers will now be banned from the previous requirement to request official permission before holding any kind of worship services. Some believe that registration is used for more effective state control, since officials now have the legal right to know what occurs at every meeting of any registered religious group. If church members or members of other religious communities refuse to provide officials with information about their gatherings, they risk having their communities charged with violation of registration requirements. Others note that harassment of religious communities has eased in the past year. Last year, the State Department did not designate Turkmenistan as a country of particular concern, or CPC. Under the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act, the president is supposed to designate as CPCs those countries whose governments have engaged in, quote, systematic, ongoing, and egregious, close quote, violations of their obligations to respect international norms on freedom of religion or belief. The USURF has recommended, the USURF being the commission where I work, has recommended since 2000 that Turkmenistan be named a CPC, but the State Department has never recommended to the president that Turkmenistan be so named. So future prospects, and I'd be very glad to hear from some of you what you think on that score. Of course, it's still very early to make any predictions. On the one hand, it's certainly not a good sign that Turkmenistan violated its own constitutional provisions on succession. The Deputy Prime Minister Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov was named interim president, and the constitutionally designated interim succession, the Speaker of Parliament, was arrested soon after Niyazov died on December 21st. In addition, a new law specifies that the country's new president must have lived in Turkmenistan for the past, I think it is, 10 years, thereby eliminating from competition the country's political opposition, most of whom live in exile in Russia or Western Europe. On the other hand, though, Berdimuhamedov, speaking to Turkmenistan's voters in both Russian and Turkmen, which in itself is a welcome signal of change, set forth a campaign platform that moved away from some of Niyazov's most repressive educational and public health politics and policies. He also seemed to signal a new openness to the world community when he pledged that the country's population would now again be able to receive the international internet. For some suggestions as to what the USERF would like to see the U.S. government advocate vis-a-vis the new Turkmenistan government, I have some material I'd be happy to give anyone who's interested. I have some printouts on that score. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Thank you to our panelists. We'll go ahead and open a discussion. If I may, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask the first question. My question is directed to Igor. With regard to the, I mean, you discussed social attitudes towards converts from Islam to mainly Christian faiths, and you cited, you said that there were two reasons for two reasons possibly why that they might view this in a negative light. From this discussion, I wanted to understand from you, does this mean that state policies or social attitudes towards converts are the conversion is viewed negatively when we're speaking of conversion among the Kazakh, Kyrgyz, the Muslim populations, as opposed to conversion from Russian Orthodoxy to other Christian faiths? Or is the state policy does the state policy not distinguish between conversion directed towards Muslims and conversion directed towards Christians?
Officially, first, it depends what country. Proselytism is prohibited only in Uzbekistan. In other republic, officially in Turkmenistan too, it is not proselytism is not prohibited. Only Uzbekistan proselytism is prohibited. But it seems to me that it is a question about official position, about legislation, or about practice. In practice, of course, Uzbek government first afraid Muslim who have converted to Christianity. But really, they don't care about it. It's not. They don't look. The Uzbek government is quite secular, and for them it is not so important if some Muslim have converted to Christianity. But in private conversations, they said to me that this situation provokes some bloody conflict, and I can agree with this government position. And if, for example, some Orthodox people have converted to to Protestant, government don't care about it. But officially, there are not difference between proselytized Christianity, proselytism, and from Muslim to Christianity. And in other republic, in Kazakhstan and in Kyrgyzstan, it seems to me that really government don't care about it very hard. But now situation little is changing in Kyrgyzstan. Authorities started not officially, but started stop proselytism because, and in private conversation, some people said me, it is a leader of religious committee in the south of Kyrgyzstan, they said that, I showed some poster, that Christian, Protestant missionaries are very active, and we are only, and situation in the south of Kyrgyzstan are very tension, as a speaker said about the killing of Kamalov, and there are big influence of some Islamic radical organization, and they said we only afraid that it started the war if Christian missionary will continue the activity, and they said that we have to change our religious law, maybe not openly prohibit proselytism like in Uzbekistan, but we won't limit activity of Christian missionary. It is in southern Kyrgyzstan, and maybe Eric said about it, but in southern Kyrgyzstan, the most hard population of southern Kyrgyzstan are Uzbek. The most problem is not in Kyrgyz, but in Uzbek region of southern Kyrgyzstan. For example, Kamalov was Uzbek too, and they afraid. In Kazakhstan, I think it is not a big problem. And in Turkmenistan, some people said in private discussion, it is official, not official view, that in Soviet time we were victim of Russian colonizers who press us communist ideology, and now West try distribute West ideology with supporting of Protestant missionaries.
Hello. Steve Benson from Literal Solutions Incorporated. This question is for Eric. You mentioned last year was the worst year, and that there was uprising after uprising. Can you characterize the violent nature of these uprisings, whether there's a trend, one direction or another, size, that kind of thing?
I think if there is a piece of good news, it is that by and large they haven't been violent. They have been peaceful, and I think that's why I would hesitate to label any of this militant or radical, although the government doesn't hesitate to label it militant or radical. By and large, it has been. It's been peaceful. And the ideology behind the uprisings, most of them don't even move towards the ideology of Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir claims to be peaceful, but they have a fairly provocative ideology. The uprisings that we've seen in Kyrgyzstan are more kind of mainstream Muslim protests against what they perceive as either injustice or a lack of knowledge on the part of the muftiyat, rather than some campaign for a global caliphate. So it's been peaceful, but it has been very decidedly anti-state, and I think that's where the tension comes in. It could, depending on what the state does and which groups Kyrgyz begin to gravitate towards, you could see it. You could potentially see that change.
This is for Igor. I hope you don't get into trouble or lose your job for agreeing with an Uzbek official. I'm interested in Uzbekistan and your view of the Andijan uprising. To what extent were Islamic fundamentalist groups, organizations, individuals involved in that? And to what extent is the Western view that this was a peaceful demonstration that was put down by violent government action correct? Can you tell us who the different actors were, to the best of your knowledge, what the religious dimension is?
Okay. First, I gave the other talks in Open Society Institute in New York about this topic, and tomorrow I will tell about this topic in Jamestown Foundation, because Corey asked me that I don't stress about this topic, because I have a big topic, pitched 40 minutes about this topic, but now I say third. It is not clear now. Is Akramia terrorist or for me myself? Is Akramia terrorist organization or not? Before uprising, I met with Akramia leaders. Leaders were in prison, but their relative and some hidden secret member for Akramia people, and these people said me that show me their views, their theory. And really, I think that Akram Yuldashev have some teaching who really change some Islamic rule. For example, Yuldashev teach that for Muslim, it is not necessary to pray five times per day or fast during Ramadan. He have also interesting social system. I because I call these systems Islamic socialism. For example, he established a system of Islamic factories where owner and worker live as brothers. And for example, it is like communist system. For example, if you are sick, the owner help you by money and by medical drug. If you are married, the owner have to give you money too, and sometimes apartment. And this is interesting, some economic system, and Uzbek government was afraid this system very hard, that he established some mutual fund. And if you are good Muslim, not all people, for example, Protestant or Orthodox can't, you can take money from this fund, and if your business is good, you can return back. If not, not. So they want to encourage Islamic business. So before rebellion, there are not real evidence, but it is very difficult question because I can speak about this 40 minutes. But before rebellion, it looked more like social and some heresy maybe. I spoke with former Mufti of Uzbekistan and his enemy of Islam Karimov, Muhammad Sadegh Muhammad Yusuf. He said to me that it is not terrorist organization, but it's a heresy. Heresy, you understand? Heresy organization, because Yuldashev changed Islam. So before uprising, we can look only this is socialist and heresy Islamic doctrine. But when rebellion occurred, for I have many questions, and it is interesting. I looked to West journalist during the Azerbaijan rebellion, and sometimes I am not agree with American journalists because it is a little strange. But before rebellion, before uprising, all Crimea member agree that it is organization. They call themselves not Akrami, but Birodar, Brotherhood in Farsi. But they agree that this is organization. After uprising, during uprising, they said it is not organization. We are only Muslim, and West newspaper writes the same, that it is not. But really, it was organization. I'm not sure that it is terrorist organization, but it is organization. Other question for me, very interesting, strange, that I'm sure that this rebellion, this uprising, was organized very good. For example, the demonstrator, so-called peaceful demonstrator, effectively attacked military garrison, and they arrested, I don't know how much, but many soldiers with guns. Please. And then they took Andijan prison, and it is the second for difficulty prison in the former Soviet Union. So it is very good organized group. Third question. First, before uprising, there was some demonstrated and some demonstration, and the demonstrator only ordered liberation of Islamic businessman, member of Crimea. And the demonstrators took prison, liberated this businessman. So they achieved their goal. But they didn't finish rebellion. It is very easy. I have some picture. It is Andijan is 20 kilometers from Kyrgyz border, and it Kyrgyz border, Kyrgyz Uzbek border, in reality don't protect it, and they can transport these businessmen to Kyrgyzstan, and nobody touch them in Kyrgyzstan, and it is finished. But they didn't do it. They continue rebellion. So I think that the main goal is not liberation businessman, but maybe take power. But as a position, I am not sure. Nobody know. But it seems to me that maybe at first Akrami was peaceful organization, but after provocative, I agree with it, policy of Islam Karimov, they is changing their views.
University of Cambridge. Oh, thank you. Christopher Swift, University of Cambridge. It seems to me that in the region generally, we have two major tensions, and each of your presentations underscores these tensions. The first being questions of security, be it energy security or be it security relative to transnational terrorist syndicates. And the second is questions of liberty, namely the actions of government towards minorities or even majorities within their own countries. And I have two questions regarding this balance between liberty and security in U.S. foreign policy. The first is for Catherine Cosman, and that is, if you were making recommendations to the U.S. government on how to address energy security relations with Turkmenistan while at the same time advancing the religious freedom question, what three things would you put before them? And the second question is for Dr. McClinchy, which is to say, when we are distinguishing between these grassroots Muslim organizations in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, and organizations that the governments in these countries claim are radical or connected with international terrorist syndicates, what objective criteria should we in the West be using in drawing these sorts of distinctions?
Thank you, Chris. Well, as I indicated, there are many suggestions spelled out here, so I will quote three of the points that I think are particularly significant. I'm sure everyone here knows that Turkmenistan has the world's fifth largest reserves of natural gas, and it also, even despite its large territory, only has a population of 5 million. Therefore, if the enormous actual and potential wealth from the gas reserves were managed in some kind of transparent and decent fashion, the people of Turkmenistan could live extremely well along the lines, say, of some of the policies adopted in the Emirates. But needless to say, unfortunately, this has been extremely far from the case so far. And one can only hope that the U.S. government would, in fact, while encouraging alternative gas routes, to which I know the new government has committed, the new Turkmen government has committed itself, so as to get away from Russia having such a large say over Turkmenistan's and the disposal of Turkmenistan's gas reserves. I think it's extremely important to try to be consistent to our own international commitments and our own domestic laws vis-a-vis, among other things, religious freedom and respect for human rights. You know, I mentioned the fact that in the scenario for the upcoming February presidential elections, the U.S. government has already gone on record as saying, well, it's really up to the Turkmen to decide how they should design that. But I do believe very strongly that, and as does the Commission more importantly, that the government should be encouraged to take significant steps to start dismantling the personality cult. I think that some of the specifics of the educational reforms outlined by the leading contender of the six to be president of Turkmenistan do indicate a possibility that that may happen. So I think that's definitely a positive sign. But furthermore, I think the law and religion should be made in conformity with its international commitments. And as I think I've indicated, that would do a lot to free other aspects of Turkmen society. I certainly agree with some of Eric's comments about how different countries in this part of the world are all searching for finding a balance in, you know, domestic sources, international resources on how to really build or rebuild, in some cases, a national tradition of Islam in a positive sense. And then, of course, the awkward position, to put it mildly, of governments and government officials who've only grown up in an intensely secular, if not atheist, background and training, and how they deal with that. I mean, it would be somewhat surprising if they were well informed and favorable towards religion, and that of course is far from the case. So nevertheless, I think policies towards religion go a large way in helping these countries redefine their national identities, cultural traditions, as well as more, you know, specific religious dimensions, and also, you know, education. And finally, I think if the U.S. government could encourage the Turkmen authorities to move closer to and in a more significant way than they have so far towards the international community, towards its obligations under the UN, invite, you know, these very 10, I believe it is, observers or rapporteurs from the UN have requested admission to the Turkmenistan and all been denied. Although Niyazov a few years ago did begin making a few tentative and rather cosmetic moves towards the UN, nevertheless, I think that should be very much encouraged. And finally, I think the OSCE, the Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe, has some expertise that could also be called upon to help revise the religion law in a positive way.
I'll try to be brief for what is actually a really difficult question and well-crafted question. I'm a positivist and an empiricist, so what I'm about to say is going to sound very odd, probably. I think the language that we employ is critical. And I have to say, I think I disagree with your dichotomy. I think the dichotomy that you just phrased, the choice between or these categories of security and liberty are false categories. So the categories that the governments of Central Asia would like us to buy into, particularly the governments of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, but I don't think they're necessarily the categories that we should be looking at. So in this case, I think language is very important, and I think Karimov would like us to believe that's what the choice is, whereas in reality that's really not the choice. So that would be my answer briefly. I'd just like to say that, you know, I've been working in this region for a decade, and Igor has been working in the region much longer, and I defer to his expertise. But I would just say that my interpretation of Andijan differs from Igor's. And if you get two people who've devoted so much time to this question, who can come up with two such differing interpretations, I think it's very hard to come up with any rubric to identify what is a radical organization and what isn't. So I would be. There's a new movement in the U.S. government to start using something called the F process, where we can identify, you know, how many groups we work with, et cetera, et cetera. No, the U.S. government isn't trying to do this with identifying radical groups. But if we were to use some other kind of metric, I think it would be flawed. Because if and again, I defer to Igor, but if two people who devote their lives to this can't figure it out, I think I would be hesitant to label or identify anyone rubric.
Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. The panelists have understandably focused on policies of state governments, but obviously in Central Asia, state borders are often quite artificial. And I'd like to ask the panelists to talk a bit about one region where state borders come together, the famous Fergana Valley, which has not actually been mentioned specifically so far today. And yet a great deal of the population concentrations, a great deal of the Western mythology about is, or perhaps I should say Western sense of concern about Islamic radicalism in this part of Central Asia focuses on this one piece of real estate. So I'd like to get any thoughts that the three panelists have about how the dynamics of religion, and not just state policy, but actual the dynamics of religion within the populations, and I emphasize the plural, of the Fergana Valley may be changing.
Very interesting question. I'll take it from Igor on down. question being, are the dynamics of religion and among the populations in the Ferghana Valley, are those changing in different ways because of, primarily I think because of the cross-border activity?
Because of?
Of the cross-border activity, okay. The cross-border links.
In other words, forget the state.
My English or problem of my mind. I don't understand clear the question, but the first I try to answer. If not to you, okay. The first for me it is, in my opinion, it is very important that in Soviet time the border in Central Asia were marked voluntarily.
Involuntary.
So, for example, in the beginning of the 20th century, when you ask Muslim and people in Central Asia, what is your nation, they said Muslim. So there are not Uzbek, Kyrgyz, Tajik, Kazakh. They don't identify themselves like nation. And in the Soviet time, and some people think that some journalists write that it is a secret bomb in Central Asia, that when Stalin do borders between the states, it is not a real border. For example, Osh, southern Kyrgyzstan, it is typical Uzbek border. Uzbek region, and now Uzbek are divided from Kyrgyz. Uzbek are divided from Uzbekistan. Okay, but it is theory. But if you say about Ferghana Valley, it is one ethnic culture region, and maybe I'm not sure, but maybe it's more logical unite all Ferghana Valley in one country. That, for example, some part to Uzbekistan, some part to Tajikistan, some part to Kyrgyzstan. Now, Ferghana Valley is divided, one ethnic culture region is divided between three countries. And if you look geographically, Uzbek part of Ferghana Valley are more close for economically, for culture, to southern Kyrgyzstan, that to other part of Uzbekistan. So Uzbek from Ferghana Valley, it is not the same as Tashkent Uzbek. So it is one ethnic culture region, and when the division this region between three countries, it is like catastrophe. We every time it can provoke big problem. I can some photo maybe I will show. From other my speech that now because there are big problem Kyrgyz Uzbek border because Uzbek live in Kyrgyzstan and in the Uzbek part of Ferghana Valley and in Kyrgyz part of Ferghana Valley and now there is a border. It is very big problem because Uzbek soldiers try to give some bribes for people who crossing the border, and everywhere you can look illegal crossing border. So first very big problem, it is a border problem, because it is one region, it was divided. Second problem, some people, some ethnologists think that all conflict in Central Asia is provoked, are provoked by land with water. And in Ferghana Valley is a special region in all Central Asia because it is the maximum number of people for land with water. So it is like Parakhovoy Kotel. You don't understand?
Parakhovoy
Kotel.
Boiling. All Central Asia. And this economical and ethnic tension are very links with Islamic radical because it is like other side of one problem.
So it will be dangerous in future too. I don't understand. I answer for your question or other question.
Borders, unfortunately, are important, and we can't dispense with states because the difference in the regimes means that there becomes a knock-on effect in society. So there's a difference in society. So society in Kyrgyzstan, the Uzbek society in Kyrgyzstan, has considerably greater freedoms than the society in Uzbekistan. So for me, it's analytically hard to separate them, but I think you're right to say that there is a common culture. So let me address it at that level. And while I recognize the important differences that society has, and let me just give you a few examples. I just came back from Ocean Jalalabad. I was there a couple of weeks ago. One very interesting conversation I had was with Ali Sher Saip from Fergana.ru. And Ali Sher is trying to reach the Uzbek population in Uzbekistan using an interesting strategy. Basically, Fergana.ru makes about $1,000 a month through Google advertising, through you and my going there and reading it. And the U.S. is the biggest consumer of Fergana.ru, ironically. What he's trying to do is use this money to produce a weekly paper version of what's on Fergana.ru and distribute it at the Karasu Bazaar. The Karasu Bazaar is frequented by about 30,000 Uzbek traders every week, and the idea is that they would put this in their pocket and bring it back to Uzbekistan. So it's the idea of the shared culture and information transmission across otherwise closed borders. Let me just pick up one last thing about these closed borders. I don't know if it's going to stick or not, but at about 4 o'clock this morning when I was putting my finishing touches on this, I couldn't resist looking at the news from Uzbekistan, and apparently there's a new visa regime between Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan that's just been approved today. It's been in the works for some time. Who knows if it's going to take effect, but it's supposed to allow free travel between Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan without the visa problems that they've had. Now, I'm not overly sanguine that we will avoid the bribes that Igor rightfully talks about, but hopefully this will ease things up. A lot of the tension is based on economics, and if there can't be a free economic flow among these communities, you're going to see the tension between what are very real states.
Well, as you probably know, the Fergana Valley was the most densely populated part of the former Soviet Union. So that gives you one reason why I guess they wanted to split things up, in addition to the fact that I think the Fergana Valley is generally recognized as being the home of the most traditional, the longest Islamic traditions in Central Asia, I mean of the classical variety, the texts, the traditions, the Sufism, etc. I'm not, very well informed about that, but in contrast to the nomadic traditions, which obviously predominate in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. But I think you'll find most people there will know that Babur, the founder of the Mughal Empire in northern India, comes from the Fergana Valley. It also has a very proud historic tradition. But one can't ignore the vagaries of Soviet and Stalinist history, and of course the effects of the borders and the different policies of the governments today are extremely important. For example, in Tajikistan, women have recently been banned from going to mosque. And I would suspect that a lot of that comes from the government's worry about the infection spreading from the Fergana Valley. I also disagree with Igor's interpretation of what happened in Andijan for what that's worth. And the commission did pay an extensive visit to Uzbekistan, met with and talked with a lot of different people also in the Fergana Valley. In fact, in Andijan, that's posted on our website. Finally, I wanted to mention, going back to Turkmenistan, since that's one of my favorite spots, that it's also been, you know, artificial borders were also, you know, is also relevant there. You know, some say that cities, that Hiva should actually, which is another ancient city, should actually be part of Turkmenistan. And there's a large Turkmen diaspora, you know, going back to their nomadic roots in Iran and Afghanistan. And also, I don't quite understand, but the Turkmen in Iraq obviously have some relation to the Turkmen as well. Finally, I just wanted to end with an anecdote. When I was in the Ferghana Valley in the early 1990s, working for Human Rights Watch, I was there with Lyudmila Alexeyeva, and the very end of our 10 days there, some unofficial imams came up to us and said, "Oh, we've been looking for you. You know, we heard that two women, you know, who are here, very interested in what's going on here. We just wanted to meet with some people from the outside world who are interested in what's going on here." And it was very obvious that they were very keen on breaking out of the isolation that, you know, that these populations have been living in for a very long time, as long as Soviet rule, if not longer.
Igor, did you have some photos that you wanted to show?
But another speech in my computer. But maybe this is not so important. I have only show illegal crossing between Uzbekistan part and Kyrgyz part of Ferghana Valley. It is a little funny because they use some... they use some tire like boat, and everywhere you pay only 50 cents and you can cross illegal border. But maybe it is not. I have some photo for other speech.
It appears that we're nearing our end. I think we have. Do you have a question too?
I wanted to ask the same question, I think, or at least a corollary of it, a slightly different way. Okay, we've heard about what I think is mostly power struggles. We've heard about a power center's hostility against religion as a competitive power base. We've heard about struggle for power within the various Islamic mixes. We've heard about hostility of perhaps the recognized religions against possible imported, as you know, perhaps is a another way of diluting power of the whoever has power within the society, within the state. Are we talking only about power struggles, or are we talking about religious freedom as something that the people there value? Again, tell me about the people. Is religion important to the people there, or was it stomped out during the Soviet period? Is something that's important to the people in the society?
We'll allow each panelist to have a final word on that, and we'll conclude.
Yes and no is my, you know, majority of the population were successfully Sovietized and probably are not that interested, I think. But especially in countries like Kazakhstan, where you have a large Slavic population who I think were, you know, probably are less intensely interested. But I think Eric has well delineated some aspects of how Islam is seen as a very important part of being Turkmen, Tajik, or whoever. It's not just power, but since we've been talking about government's policies towards religion, obviously power has a lot to do with it. And I think in this town we focus a lot on political parties, but frankly, if you're talking about mobilization of large numbers of people, religion is much more important than political parties, especially in post-Soviet situations.
I think people in Central Asia turn to religion like people all over the world turn to religion. And the religion provides perhaps some answers, provides some solace. So it isn't by any stretch of the imagination about power. I began with the example of the farmer who found out that Allah's name was on his sheep. There's a natural curiosity. People want to learn that they haven't had the chance necessarily. So by no means is it only about power. In fact, it probably predominantly isn't about power. It's probably about the way and reasons why religions attract all of us for different reasons. There people find different answers in it. So power may be a thing that I, as a political scientist, focus on, but may not be the thing that Shadabek, as a Kyrgyz person, focuses on. So I think it's a good question, and perhaps we're remiss for emphasizing that. That said, let me just go back to talking about power for 1 second. You mentioned religion as a competition to state ideology. One thing I'd like to emphasize is that religion and the defining of terrorist religion actually is not a competition sometimes, but actually becomes part of the state ideology. So states define their legitimacy to the extent that they can prevent radicalism. So it's not necessarily in competition, but when you look at the Uzbek government in particular, and increasingly I fear when you look at the Bakiyev government, it's not a competition, but it becomes part of the ideology of the state. But for a very different reason for why people turn to religion as part of their own personal ideology.
Okay. No, in my opinion, the most part of Central Asia population is quite secular. It is not like Pakistan or Afghanistan. In Soviet time, most people... for example, it is not real now in Uzbekistan or Tajikistan. It is most hard believers do Islamic Republic, because the most part of population do not support this. For example, I speak with most of Uzbek women don't want to wear hijab. For example, Karimov said about Islamic, about the danger that Islamists can take power, it is not true, but they can do some destabilization, it's true. But in my opinion, maybe it is not a West style of mind, I'm sorry, but I don't believe that, for example, now totally regime in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, I don't believe democratic alternative. Other alternative, it is Islamic alternative. They can't win. But we can. As Russian correspondent, I worked in civil war in Tajikistan in 1992-94. And there was two forces. One, it is not real communist, but it's close to communist forces. And other forces, it was coalition of Democratic Party and Islamic Party. But then we look, the Democratic Party play only very little role in this war. And at first they started as democratic movement, but then they understand that if they want that people go with them, they won't use other slogans. And during the war, they use only Islamic slogans. And really, there are two forces: Islamic force, and maybe only 5% of democratic sum. It is very little, and communist slogans, unfortunately.
I just wanted to add a very quick, cynical note. I think the primary motivation of most governments in Central Asia is to stay in power. It's not to prevent radicalism. I wish that were the case. I mean, radicalism as sensibly defined.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. I would like to extend our heartiest thanks to all three panelists, in particular Igor, for having traveled so far. We will continue to read your works with much interest. We look forward, Eric, to your forthcoming manuscript, and we'll be following all the reports out of the commission. Thank you very much. You've given us a considerable food for thought for the future. I appreciate it very much.